Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Paul Craig Roberts. Paul was former Assistant Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan, also a former Wall Street Journal Associate Editor. He's holder of numerous academic appointments, including at Georgetown University's Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is now a very prominent Obama administration critic. He was the same thing criticizing George Bush in both cases for their destructive, repressive policies endangering people everywhere and certainly not helping this country in the long run. The old losing formula, short-term gains for long-term losses, and it's true militarily, it's true economically. You have to wonder what kind of people run this country and what on earth are they thinking about in the long term, if not for themselves, for people who will come after them, including their offspring. Anyway, lots going on. Paul, I welcome you to the program. So many crucial issues. So we've got raging wars, despite Obama's speech last night. We've got the economic dilemma, especially here and across Europe. What do you make of all this?
What an open-ended question, Stephen.
You're the expert, Paul. You're the expert. I throw the ball. Let's talk about the economy, because you're an economist and you understand that. We certainly do not have the best of times.
No. The economy has been destroyed. There are several aspects to that. In fact, the United States actually is undergoing three crises. Only one of which is partially acknowledged. And any one of these crises is enough to cause tremendous ruin, and all three together is Armageddon. So what are these crises? Well, the one that's partially acknowledged is the financial crisis, that is, the banks, with all of their gambling and casino betting and fraudulent assets, and the way they deceived the Congress and got themselves bailed out at the taxpayers' expense. So what we've had happen this time is new in our economic experience. Instead of having corporations, that is, financial corporations, that made fundamental mistakes, have to accept haircuts and debt restructuring and eat their losses. Instead, all their mistakes were covered at book value, at face value, and by taxpayers who were forced to go out on the limb in order to be sure that the banks didn't suffer any losses from their mistakes. This has not happened in American history. And one consequence of that is large budget deficits. And so now they're saying that, oh, the deficits are so large, we have to get rid of Medicare. We need to privatize it to get it off the government's books, because we can't afford to save the multi-billionaires and also pay Medicare. And Social Security is also in the target. So the consequence of breaking all the rules about bailouts is that now the social safety net is in danger and will likely be dismantled. So those are the aspects the unacknowledged aspects of the bank bailout of the financial crisis. But we have two other problems that are acknowledged. One is that the bailouts have resulted in a massive creation of new money by the Federal Reserve, because it's called quantitative easing, which is a euphemism, and what they're really doing is monetizing debt. The Federal Reserve is creating new money to finance the Treasury's deficit. The Fed buys the bonds by giving the Treasury checking accounts or demand deposits, and the Treasury draws on this newly created money to pay its bills. Well, what that's doing is causing all other countries in the world to look askance at the dollar, which is the reserve currency. They're saying, how in the world can this be a reserve currency when they're printing it hand over fist? And look, we all have our reserves in dollars. That is, we thought they were valuable. Here we are holding them in our central banks, and here is the American Central Bank creating them as fast as it can. And so maybe we should get out of dollars. And so we've seen quite a remarkable decline in the exchange value of the dollar. For example, I can remember when one U.S. dollar traded for 4.2 Swiss francs. It now trades for 0.83.
Oh, my goodness, I didn't realize that, Paul.
It's an amazing change. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. And so now we are getting inflation from dollar decline, because up goes the price of oil. Up goes, because it's priced in dollars. If the dollar's perceived as a, if the dollar's losing in exchange value to keep themselves even, the oil producers raise the price. Otherwise, they're taking a real loss. The same with, so we now have the price of gasoline at over $4 a gallon. And the same thing for food, you know. Most commodities are priced in dollars, grains. So we see these enormous rises in food prices. So that part of the crisis really isn't acknowledged. But then the worst part of the worst of the three isn't acknowledged at all. And that is that for 20 years, ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, American corporations have been offshoring their jobs. So instead of producing the goods that they sell in American markets with American labor inside the United States, they've moved all these jobs offshore, and they're producing the products that they sell to Americans with Chinese labor, Indonesian labor, Indian labor. And so Americans are separated now, or their incomes are separated from the production of the goods and services that they consume. So we have had no growth in consumer income, except for the top rich bankers that are bailed out. There's no growth in consumer income for 20 years. And so how did they keep the economy going? And that was Alan Greenspan's low interest rates. We'll make consumer debt cheap, and consumers will then substitute an increase in indebtedness for the lack of increase in income, and they can continue to spend that way by running up their debt burdens. And, of course, that's where the real estate bubble came from, which for a while contributed to the success of Greenspan's policy, because housing prices rose, people refinanced their homes, spent the equity, and so they kept the economy driven with the expansion of consumer debt. But you see, there's a limit to that. And that's what has been reached. People are now so in debt that they can't service the debt they already have, their car bills, their student loans, their mortgages, their credit card debts. So So the economy is dead in the water. It can't move. The bankers, which have controlled the Treasury and the Federal Reserve since the Clinton administration.
By the way, Paul, all of your writing is marvelous. Yeah. And I was so taken by the writing that you did about the destruction of industrial America, this shifting America's industrial base, not just to China, but to cheap labor markets. And I guess the part of the idea is to reduce wages in America, work closer and closer to parity to what a Chinese worker earns. Maybe someday that's what an American worker will earn. And the bankers get rich. I mean, they get rich no matter what goes on. They get rich from wars. They get rich from the money printing and all the rest. And but no country can prosper if it literally destroys its industrial base, and the only thing we're heading for are cheap jobs, cheap service jobs, low pay service jobs for most people, or go into the military and get your head blown off. Well, that's not the kind of future that I had or you had when we were growing up, but that's what most kids have to look forward to today. And I mean, this is a very bad end game out there.
Well, that's right. And it's not, Stephen, it's not just the manufacturing base that's moved offshore. It's also all the professional service jobs that American college and university graduates used to take.
Oh, I agree.
All software engineering, computing, all kinds of engineering, research, design. All of this can now be done anywhere on Earth and sent in over the high-speed Internet.
The only stuff we don't want to offshore are the secret stuff related to military and all that. We'll keep that at home. But any parts of that that we don't worry about keeping secret, that can go abroad as well.
And Stephen, you might be surprised to know that even secret stuff goes.
Oh, my goodness. Deliberately?
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, it's been true for years. I mean, for... You know, the sites used on the big Abrams tank, they come in from foreign countries, and it's so much of the stuff. In fact, you know, a great deal now of just military operations is privatized, and it's in the private sector, and some of the firms are not domestic-based. And so... But what the point is we have thousands of colleges and universities, and they're producing graduates. And yet the jobs that are available, other than school teachers, veterinarians, doctors, lawyers, and dentists, don't require a college education. You don't need a college education to work in domestic services, waitresses, bartenders, hospital orderlies, you know, manicurists. These types of jobs are all that are left, and it's all that's been created in the last 18 years.
Now, Paul, you've also deconstructed the so-called jobs numbers where we show so many created. But if you accurately explain how these numbers are put together, and you've done it at least in several articles that I read, you show that the formula has been changed from the way we did it 20 or 30 years ago, and the real numbers. I mean, we have this crazy birth death ratio. That may work, job creation and small business that may not be picked up as easily on the surveys or whatever. But in good times, that may have some validity. But in hard times, how do you automatically plug in so many thousands of jobs created when small businesses are more likely to be letting people go than adding them? And I remember one article you wrote that I think it was the month that 220,000 jobs were reported by the Labor Department, and reconstructing these numbers or deconstructing these numbers, we actually lost jobs when you take out all this fictitious creation. And most of the jobs created, as you say, they are not the high paying good jobs for most people, and so many of them are part time jobs. So here today, gone tomorrow, they'll hire you on a temporary basis if they need you, and they can dump you tomorrow if they don't, and it's all a very sorrowful situation.
Well, that's true. You summed it up well.
And then we've got these wars raging, Paul. You know, we've got no money to build the economy at home, but we've got an open-ended budget to fight these wars, and we've added the Libya one on now. And today I decided to write about Obama's speech last night, beginning to pull troops out of Afghanistan. There is no question that we have ever since we went to Iraq and Afghanistan, the policy has been permanent occupation, Paul. There's no doubt about that. And the example I like to give, and I've said it before, is think Germany, think Japan, think South Korea, Italy. We arrived in those places back in 1945. We occupied them. We're still there.
That's right.
And also, Paul, at a time when this country literally has no enemies anywhere, what country could possibly threaten this one? What country with a sane leader, even a demented leader, would ever want to challenge America militarily? We could literally hand them their head, hand them the heads of everyone in the country in 24 hours or less. That's impossible, and yet we claim these enemies, so-called war on terrorism, or bad guys in the countries we decide to wage wars with, and this endless military budget where we're spending much more than the official numbers, and it seems like an open-ended checkbook to keep doing this at a time homeland needs go begging. Again, this seems self-destructive to me.
Well, you know, President Eisenhower warned the country 50 years ago that the military-industrial complex was a new threat on the horizon, that at the end of our previous wars, we had dismantled the defense industries. But because of the Soviet threat, as they called it, we had kept them going and kept funding them, and that now they had emerged as a power as great as the government. And certainly the military security complex, together with Wall Street, APEC, the oil industries, comprise the ruling oligarchy in the United States. They control who gets elected, what bills are brought up, which ones are passed by Congress, which ones the president signed. And the people themselves, who think that they have representatives, are deluded, because the representatives don't represent the people. They represent these powerful moneyed interests that fund their campaigns and provide them with high-paying jobs when they leave the government and the Congress. So we have a situation in which the people no longer have a voice, and it really doesn't matter who they elect. Obama has proven that. You know, you might remember the change. Nothing has changed. It's a continuation of the same military security complex policies, you know, wars to enrich us, that is, to enrich the military security complex, bailouts and money printing for the banks. That's all continued. Everything that the oligarchy demands, they get. And you asked earlier, what about the long run? Well, in the long run, we're all dead, as John Maynard Keynes said. And these people are thinking about the immediate present. You know, what? How much more money can we get? Well, let's don't have any peace, because what will happen, we'll have less revenues coming in from the government, and our stock will go down. So we move from war to war. And they never end one without starting another. So, you know, we have Libya, and I think Syria is on the horizon. Iran is still waiting. And these wars get more and more reckless because attacking Iraq is one thing, though we never succeeded in occupying Baghdad. We had to end that war by putting 80,000 Sunni insurgents on the U.S. military payroll and pay them to stop fighting us. That's how that was wound down. But in Libya, you see, we are challenging Chinese interests. The Chinese have massive oil investments in eastern Libya. And that's the reason we started that war. We were trying to separate China from having any independent energy sources in order to delay their rise, because Washington has been alarmed by the report from the International Monetary Fund that within 5 years, China will surpass the United States as the world's most powerful economy. So we hide behind Arab protest in Libya, but it's really a confrontation with China. That's a different order of magnitude than Iraq.
China, indeed, is the growing economic rival, and at the same time, you know, it's hard to imagine that this country would ever want to fight a war with China. You never know what could possibly happen, Paul.
They didn't want to fight a war with Japan either. But they cut Japan off from oil, raw materials, rubber. And that led to Pearl Harbor.
Oh, it sure did. It sure did. My point about China is U.S. corporations manufacture their products in China. They certainly don't want their factories or their affiliated factories bombed. So, and they, of course, decide who we will fight wars with or who we won't. So maybe the challenge is non-military, but you never know. You challenge in one way, and things can go a different way than you may wish. But that threat is always out there. But China absolutely is a great economic rival, and Russia is the military rival because it can come close to matching us with the nuclear threat. I mean, if we decide to lob a few at them, they can lob a few back at us, and that's the MAD equation, M-A-D equation, that existed during the Cold War that kept us from doing it to each other. But China is, Russia is the military rival, and the idea is to reduce that challenge as much as possible, but it's a dangerous game, Paul. It's like playing with firecrackers, hoping it won't blow a finger off. You never know what's going to happen.
Well, it's not clear that China's not in the military crosshairs, but since you mentioned Russia, that's really what Syria is all about. We've stirred up all the trouble in Syria because we want regime change in order to put in a puppet that will close down the Russian naval base at Tartus. You see, Syria has given Russia a naval base in the Mediterranean. And
the only one it has, Paul, and they absolutely want to hold on to it. And you can understand why they do. And that's the key reason why they want no part of a Resolution 1973 equivalent against Syria.
What I think the better way to look at it, Stephen, is the United States doesn't want a Russian naval presence in the Mediterranean.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, what you have to notice about the Libyan and the Syrian protest is they're not protests like Egypt or Tunisia or Bahrain, which we were pleased to see suppressed with violence. In Libya and Syria, the protests are armed rebellions. They did not originate as people protesting in the capitals. They originated in sections of the country easy to infiltrate and to arm. And so these are armed rebellions sponsored by the United States, engineered by the CIA, and the purpose was to set up the regimes for NATO intervention so that we could get rid of China's oil investments in Libya. And the same thing is coming to Syria because they want to get rid of the, Washington wants to get rid of the Soviet naval base. So what I'm making these points for is it shows that the risk in these wars escalate because even though we pretend we're not confronting Russia and China, that these are merely Arab protests, we're using the protests as a veil in which to confront China and Russia, and they both know it.
By the way, Paul, Syria and Iran have a military security pact, and I don't know the precise language, but I think it's to the effect that if one country is attacked, the other will go to its defense. So if that's in fact what could happen, it was like the Japanese-German Axis alliance.
That would suit Washington fine because Iran as well.
But it would ignite a general war in the region, and Iran is not a cupcake to blow over. Syria isn't that easy, but a lot easier, I think, than Iran. But you get with all the wars going on now, you ignite two more that literally engulfs the whole region. And again, who can tell? I mean, would Russia want to get involved in this? Would China want to get involved in this? I mean, this looks a little bit like the way World War I began.
Well, as I said, these risks are unacknowledged, and it's reckless. The government in Washington is reckless because it's driven by the military security complex's desire for ever more profits. We got to have wars forever. And it's driven by the neoconservative doctrine of U.S. hegemony. And so that is the operative thinking in the think tanks and the military security complex drives the rest with its political contributions and its power. So, and you know, and it also has plants in every state. So the senators don't want the plant closed or working at reduced shifts or whatever. So the whole thing is organized for war. And how do you stop it? It's almost impossible because there's no way that people can have any effect through elections. Whoever you elect, even if they say they're against all this, once they get there, they find out they have to be for it, or they're out, or they're simply ignored, like Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich, two guys who actually have some awareness of the situation and have some principles and who aren't bought and paid for, and yet the colleagues ignore them because if you pay attention to them, you'll be without money and support as well.
And you have to wonder, Paul, if either one of them ever became president, would they really follow the lines that they preach now?
They would never let them be president.
Well, they never will be president. That's right. And even Ron Paul is doing well in these straw polls or whatever they're holding now. But I think the long knives are out for him to see to it that he never does get the nomination. And he very much is anti-war. He wants the Federal Reserve System changed. I mean, he's very outspoken. And he gets a lot of public support, which is the reason they go after him, and they absolutely want to prevent his becoming president. But, you know, whether Obama gets elected, as you say, Paul, or whether a Republican comes into office, it's going to be the same destructive system that goes on. So I like to say everything changed but stayed the same, and we're on this destructive path going to God only knows where. I also say, Paul, I'm glad I'm not young anymore.
Yeah.
I would not want to grow up in a country like this. It wasn't this way in the 40s and 50s when I grew up, or this way when you grew up. And, you know, I mean, we remember Vietnam, and I certainly remember Korea also. Back in college, we used to say we had to keep our grades up, so we weren't sent to the frozen chosen, as we used to say. I still remember that phrase up in North Korea. And now, I mean, you'll get sent anywhere, and this thing is so much worse than it ever was before. But, oh, my goodness, we're out of time, Paul. Just a final thought before we end the program.
You mean for me?
For you.
Yeah. Well, you know, Stephen, I saw the other day that Gerald Celente was saying the solution is to have referendums. We just have a referendum democracy. The people vote on everything, and nothing can happen without a majority vote. So that would be one way of giving people a voice again. Something to think about.
It's something to think about. The Venezuelan Constitution over a decade ago was passed by two referenda, as a matter of fact. One, do you want a referendum on the Constitution? And the second one, on the Constitution, and they both passed overwhelmingly. Oh, my goodness. Referendum democracy, Paul, that would really be a change. It would drive the oligarchs crazy, wouldn't it? Paul,
yep.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful program. I look forward to getting you back real soon to continue this thing. The crises aren't going away, and your thoughts are so important. Again, my hat's off to you for your important work.
Well, thank you for sharing your audience, Stephen.
Thank you, Paul. And join us this weekend, of course, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. More of the same, with more important guests on these vital topics that you'll never hear about, honestly, on CNN and the rest. You know that. Make this a regular habit.